Again. It gives me enormous pleasure to welcome Gregory Doran, the Chief Associate Director of the Royal Shakespeare Company. Greg's productions have delighted many of us here for many years, and of course this year he's brought onto stage something which has been bubbling in his imagination and his artistic endeavour for many years, actually. We'll hear more about that in a moment. And Shakespeare scholars all over the world thank Tiffany Stern for Documents of Performance in Early Modern England, her latest book from Cambridge University Press. And I have really brought together this afternoon two very different views of Cardenio. So the plan is that we hear from Greg and Tiffany in the first half, and then we have a break of 20 minutes or so, and then please come back and raise questions and points for discussion in the second half that you'd like to be taken up. How many of you have seen the current production? Ah, that's helpful to know. Thank you. So, Greg, if I give that to you there.
Yes, right.
And really, I wonder if you could say a little bit about where Cardenio started for you. That would be great.
Am I talking into that bit there? Just so I get this right. I suppose I was trying to trace it back recently. I did the first Shakespeare I ever did for the RSC was All Is True, Henry VIII. I'm going to stop whining. No? There. And the Fletcher-Shakespeare collaboration, as far as we know. And I had in rehearsal the scholar Gordon McMullen. I have a feeling it might be me going with that. Is it? No. Gordon, I asked Gordon about Fletcher and thought I ought to know more about John Fletcher and his plays, because it seemed to me as, you know, at the end of the 17th century they were regarded as a great triumvirate, Johnson, Shakespeare and Fletcher, and yet we never do Fletcher. In the entire history of the Royal Shakespeare Company we have done the Maid's Tragedy and that was it, I think. So I was fascinated to ask Gordon what other plays Fletcher might have done, and he led me towards four or five, of which I've now, I think, done three. One of which was the sequel to The Taming of the Shrew, The Tame and Tamed. And I just became fascinated by how these two men collaborated and why they collaborated, if indeed they did collaborate. It seemed to me to be a rather interesting subject. And I was then introduced to the fact that they had apparently collaborated on a third play alongside Henry VIII and Two Noble Kinsmen, which was Cardenio, which I think at that point I called Cardenio. But in the know, Cardenio. I have to tell you. So I started looking around, at the trust, the library came up with a photocopy for me of Double Falsehood, which I then duly read, and it seemed as though the little pieces of this Cardenio jigsaw puzzle were floating into place, because around about the same time, around about 2000, Michael Wood was doing the series In Search of Shakespeare for the BBC and had asked me to help sort of construct, the Shakespeare bits of that. And he had come across in the papers of the lutenist and composer Robert Johnson a single song which he thought could indeed be a lost song from Cardenio. So there were all these little elements that kept on coming into play. And then I started, when I was doing The Tame and Tamed, I got a group of actors together from the company that year, including Emma Fielding and Anton Lesser and Rory Kinnear, and we read Double Falsehood. And the weird experience was that it was a rather unsatisfactory experience. I was rather hoping that this was, you know, going to really work immediately. And to me it sort of, there were clearly at least three missing scenes in the Double Falsehood, and a major problem was that the betrayed relationship, the friendship between the Cardenio character and the villain Fernando character, which echoes the Two Gentlemen of Verona situation between Proteus and Valentine, had no setup at all. So there was no friendship to betray. And in fact, in The Double Falsehood, I think the two don't meet until Act 5. So there were quite a few things that just simply didn't work. One of the major things was the scene where Fernando says he's going to get into... He wants to woo Dorothea, and Dorothea's not having anything to do with him. And he says, oh, well, never mind, I'll bribe her maid and get into her room. And the next scene, he comes out of the room and goes, oh, I shouldn't have done that. And you go, well, I don't believe that Shakespeare or Fletcher would have taken looked at that and gone, we must miss that scene out. They would. It's like the Lady Anne scene in Richard III. It's a great seduction scene. So it felt as though that was one missing scene. And then there's a big missing scene in the second half where Lucinda is abducted from the convent, which wasn't there either. So at that point, I rather disappointedly put it aside and thought this just doesn't work. But I kept on coming back to it, and we happened at that stage to be doing quite a few trips to Spain. The Spanish Golden Age season that Lawrence Boswell did in The Swan went to Spain, and my own productions of Coriolanus and a production of Canterbury Tales have been to Spain. And then we had the rather delightful thing of being awarded, the Royal Shakespeare Company, being awarded a gold medal from the King of Spain. And the IRC said, can you go and get it? So I went to Cordoba and met the King of Spain. And what do you say to the King of Spain? So I said, did you know that Shakespeare possibly wrote a play based on Cervantes? And he said, fantastical! So I then thought, I'll put that on the poster if I ever get round to doing it. Fantastico, the King of Spain. And then Jeremy Adams, who's one of our producers, said, you really are going to have to do this now. But while we were there, we did a classical theatre conference with Spanish colleagues. And I asked them about the story of Cardenio in the original Cervantes. And it was fascinating to hear a Spanish perspective on the story and how strong their feelings about the play was, and to discover that there were at least four adaptations in the 17th century of the Cardenio story. So I then began to think, well, maybe we can sort of put it together, find a way of putting it together. The adaptations were very, very different. They, for instance, in one of the adaptations, Dorothea turns up at the wedding with Cardenio and is behind the arras with Cardenio in that wedding scene. And she then smuggles Lucinda to the convent. So that was rather neat, I thought. And I suppose what I began to think was that this was a possibility, that we could do a sort of reconstruction. I then read the Shelton 1612 translation of Don Quixote, and looking at particularly the abduction scene, the speech that Cardenio makes, as it were, after the wedding, all that seemed to be they're textually there. It was often in first person narrative, so it was as it were already in speech. And what I then had to do was basically put it into iambic pentameter. But I did have John Barton's kitchen table one day. I said, this is either a really good idea or a really bad one, John. And he said, look, if anybody can put it into iambic pentameter now, surely you can do that. And I thought, well, this is the man that when he did King John in 1974, did bits of King John, bits of Bale's King John, and bits of his own into the play, and Michael Billington called it the best new play of 1974.
Greg, that reminds me of the fantastic title page of the RSC playtext, which I'm just going to read, because I think it's fascinating. Shakespeare's lost play reimagined after Double Falsehood or The Distressed Lovers by Lewis Theobald, 1727, apparently revised from a manuscript in the handwriting of John Downes, and conceivably adapted by Sir William Davenant for Thomas Betterton from The History of Cardenio by Mr. Fletcher and Shakespeare, 1612, performed at court in 1612-13, which may have been based on an episode in Don Quixote by Miguel de Cervantes, which was translated into English by Thomas Shelton, first published in 1612, and here adapted by Gregory Doran for the Royal Shakespeare Company, with additional Spanish material supplied by Antonio Almo, via a literal translation by Duncan Wheeler, and developed in rehearsal by the original cast.
I did worry, you see, that even by the time I got on board, it had a script writing credit longer than a Hollywood blockbuster. and I have to say that some of the hedging of bets that you witness in that list is having been given a very healthy dose of skepticism by Tiffany.
Tiffany, can we move on to you? I heard Tiffany speak at a conference at the University of Chichester in November last year, and it was an extraordinary case and a series of ideas and arguments that you were putting forward, Tiffany. So we've just heard about where the, as it were, the production has come from, and a little bit about that. And you have a very different thing that you'd like to talk about.
I do indeed. But what I want to talk about has nothing to do with this marvellous production. It really has to do with the backstory, and particularly with whether Shakespeare had anything to do with Theobald's 18th century play Double Falsehood. And what it seemed to me, I started looking into this because for some reason Cardenio and Double Falsehood were in the sort of zeitgeist, and everyone, Gary Taylor was writing a Cardenio play, and Stephen Greenblatt was writing a Cardenio play, and Arden was editing Double Falsehood, and everyone was talking about these issues, and everyone was obsessed with Shakespeare's lost play Cardenio. And because I'm a sort of archivey historian, I just simply wanted to look into what all the factual evidence was. And as I looked into it, something became clear. And that is, particularly when you're doing English literature, no one quite knows what the school of English literature is, and no one knows how to do it. And so there are a number of ways you can approach a historical problem. And one is approach it like a historian, gather all the evidence and see where the evidence takes you. And the other way you can approach it is like a lawyer. Start with your conclusion and see how you can argue up there. And it was pretty obvious that everyone wanted Shakespeare to be involved in Cardenio and found in Double Falsehood. So everyone had constructed that argument. But it seemed to me that if you looked at the history, that wasn't where the history took you. So very briefly, I'll tell you what I was finding. And I don't want to draw absolute conclusions from this, because the whole point is we haven't got a lost Cardenio, so we just don't know. But I think there are two big questions. One question is, was Shakespeare ever involved in a play called Cardenio? So that's an early modern question. And then there's an 18th century question. Did Theobald have that play or a version of that play? So two questions. And if I very briefly take the questions in turn. So we know there was a play performed in 1613 called Cardenio or Cardenna. We don't know anything about authorship from then, from that time. We just have the title of the play.
Where does that appear, Tiffany?
So these are in treasurer's accounts for performances put on at court. There are two treasurer's accounts. One is for a play called Cardenna, and one is for a play called Cardenio, which is flanked by The Alchemist, which is by Ben Jonson, but the authors aren't there. The Captain, which is by Fletcher, but again, the author isn't named. The Hotspur, and Benedict and Betteris. And what's interesting is, those are obviously Shakespeare plays, but as they're not the titles by which we know them, they are in fact the titles of heroes of those plays, it seemed to me that not only did we not know the author of Cardenio or Cardenna, but we also didn't really know whether that was the title or whether that was the name of the hero. So it seemed to me that we had very questionable 1613 information. We then have information from 1653, so Everyone, Shakespeare, Fletcher, everyone's dead. All the main people are dead. We now have a publisher who is listing plays. It's in the interregnum, so there are no plays in performance. He's listing plays he owns with a view to perhaps publishing them, or at least stopping other people publishing them. And he's listing a ton of plays, and he's listing them under author. And under F, for Fletcher, he has The History of Cardenio by Mr. Fletcher, full stop, and Shakespeare. So what that says is, he is saying Fletcher is a primary author, and he has added Shakespeare perhaps as an afterthought. When we go to the plays he says are by Shakespeare, he says Henry I and Henry II by Shakespeare and Davenport, and The Merry Devil of Edmonton by Shakespeare. And later he adds three more plays in 1660 by Shakespeare. They are King Stephen, a History, The Tragedy of Duke Humphrey, and Iphis and Iantha, or A Marriage Without a Man, a comedy. So if we are to trust this authorship designation, it is the only time when we trust Moseley to be right about Shakespeare. So it seemed to me, and that is all the early information we have. So it seems to me it's not even clear that that lost play ever had Shakespeare's hand in it. It might have, but I've given you the information, you can choose either way. So that's the early modern information. Then there's Theobald in the 18th century. Who was he? What were his interests? Well, Theobald, Louis Theobald, was a pantomime writer. He made his money working for the theatre, but he was also patronised by the literati, in particular Pope. So he's this pantomime writer, but he's got two obsessions. One of his obsessions is Shakespeare, and one of his obsessions is Cervantes. And the way his Shakespeare obsession, and he's pretty interested in Fletcher, but the way his Shakespeare obsession manifests itself is, one, he repeatedly writes in imitation of Shakespeare's style. He does this throughout his life, and he very much hopes, when he writes in imitation of Shakespeare's style, that people think he is indeed as good as Shakespeare, because otherwise he's a pantomime writer. So, for one thing, he's got an obsession with writing in Shakespeare's style, and for another, he's got an obsession as an amateur with editing Shakespeare. And he wants to have his own Shakespeare edition, but no one's going to give him a Shakespeare edition because he's a pantomime writer. So he is, in his spare time, editing Shakespeare for pleasure, and also editing Beaumont and Fletcher, also for pleasure. And then Alexander Pope comes out with a Shakespeare edition. Theobald looks at it, it's rubbish, because Alexander Pope is a great poet, but that doesn't make him a great editor. And in fact, what he's done with Shakespeare is improve Shakespeare's scansion, make his poetry better. And Theobald has done all this interesting emendation. He's done rather modern things that Pope hadn't thought to do. So Theobald publishes a book saying how terrible Pope's edition is, which is called Shakespeare Restored. And he does this in the hope of getting his own Shakespeare edition. And people are quite taken with his book. But at the same time, he's still a pantomime guy. And also, no one wants a new edition, particularly the publishers of Shakespeare yet, because they want to sell out Pope's edition first. But Theobald is obsessed with getting his own edition. And it's at this point, while he is editing Fletcher and Shakespeare, and also repeatedly writing an imitation of Shakespeare, it's at this point when he acquires what he says he is an original Shakespeare manuscript. And he says he's got an original Shakespeare manuscript, but he won't show it to people, but he'll give a version of it on the stage. So double falsehood comes into being. It is staged. Everyone goes to see it because they want to analyse whether it's a Shakespeare production or whether it's real. And people have mixed feelings. They largely think it's forged, but then that Pope is leading a big anti-Theobald backlash, so that's bound to be the case. Theobald, meanwhile, says, well, if you want to know more about it, you'd really better give me a Shakespeare edition. I won't say anything now, but if I have a Shakespeare edition, I will. And he is then given a Shakespeare edition, and he then never mentions the manuscript ever again. So it seemed to me that that story admitted of several readings. And one is that he had a manuscript. By this time he's now said he has four manuscripts. He goes from saying he has one to saying he has four to going back to saying he has one. Sometimes he says it's in Shakespeare's hand. Sometimes he says it's in the hand of the restoration prompter, John Downes. He's got one from a nobleman. He's got two he purchased. One was expensive, one was cheap. There's no records of sales of these things. We know of no nobleman who claimed to have such a manuscript, and so forth. So it seemed to me that there were a number of ways one could read his story. He might have something that he doesn't really trust enough to reveal to anyone. If he has something, and certainly there are gaps and lacunae in his text of Double Falsehood, so maybe he does indeed have, for instance, a restoration cut down, already cut down version of the Lost Cardinio. I think that is possible. I also think he doesn't need to have that. I think he could have had that. But I also think that given that he himself appears to translate the Cardinio story and publish that as a little novel, and also writes a play, The Happy Captive, based on a different bit of Don Quixote, I think it's also the case that were he to make something up, it would sound like Fletcher and Shakespeare and come out of Don Quixote. So I think there's a very confusing story there, and I think it's yet more confused by the fact that he's a Shakespeare imitator. Whatever he has, whether he has a real Shakespeare manuscript, a restoration cut-down Shakespeare manuscript, or an early modern manuscript of a Cardinio that was never by Shakespeare, which is another option. Whatever he has, he'll have written on top of it in a Shakespeare-y way, because he's a Shakespeare imitator. So one of the real problems are that the bits that sound most identifiably like Shakespeare in the text, or the bits that a computer might say are by Shakespeare, those are most likely, in a way, to be the forged bits. That in brief is the narrative. There is more to be said, but yeah.
There is. I love Lewis Tybalt. I call him Tybalt because what Tiffany didn't mention was poor old Lewis Tybalt, having taken on Alexander Pope, which must have been like taking on Private Eye. I mean, it was, you know, it was the great Augustan poet and the great age of satire, and he takes on, with no shred of self-awareness, it seems to me, he takes on Alexander Pope, and Alexander Pope then produces the Dunciad, which is the great mock epic of all the stupid people in London, and he makes Lewis Tybalt the king of all the dunces. And at this point I'm feeling as though I ought to be sort of, you know, championing the underdog, but poor old Tybalt is then somebody points out that there are some lines in the Double Falsehood in which you do feel as though there's a sort of leap in the kind of quality of the verse, and Lewis Tybalt himself says, yes, well, those are the only lines I did write just to confuse you, but the story is told by a man who was then hanged for forgery. So it gets more and more and more complicated, but I suppose one of the things that I query about this story of Lewis, he was a pantomime writer, but on the other hand, this was a new art form and immensely successful, and he was writing the classical bits in those pantomimes, mix in with a bit of Harlequin and Columbine. But also, whenever he imitated Shakespeare, he always said it was imitation of Shakespeare, and he doesn't with a Double Falsehood. So that makes me worried. And because he had studied as a lawyer, I mean, he really did try everything, Lewis. I mean, he published a dreadful novel, which I've read a bit of, and it flopped. He opened a newspaper which folded. He did do an adaptation of Richard II, in which he basically tried to apply the classical unities to Richard II and cut 1,000 lines. So if we were looking at Richard II and trying to reconstruct, if we didn't have Shakespeare's Richard II and tried to reconstruct it from Louis Dippold's version, we would really be in a very hot water indeed.
Is that a deposition that takes place from beginning to end in about 3 hours?
Yes. So I think he was, nevertheless, he did train in the law, and it seems to me as though he loved Shakespeare. So I can't see this man knowingly foisting a complete forgery on the public. But he did want to make his name, and he did want to get his own edition, and he did want to tell Pope how to edit Shakespeare.
Greg, at the back of the RSC copy, there is a really beautiful letter from you to Louis Theobald, and I wonder if you'd like to read it for us, please. I'd like to hear that.
Okay. A letter to the reviser and adapter of Double Falsehood. Dear Louis Theobald, forgive me for writing to you, but I'm rather a fan of yours. You are the man who claimed to have brought to light Shakespeare's lost play, Cardenio. If that is true, you deserve a place in the pantheon of great Shakespeareans. If it is not true, you have certainly sent a lot of people into a very merry dance indeed. Apparently, you had more than one manuscript copy of Cardenio, though how many isn't clear, and you adapted it for the stage as Double Falsehood or The Distressed Lovers. It opened at Drury Lane on 13th of December 1727 and ran for 10 consecutive performances. The advertisement for the play, which appeared in the London Journal, read, "This good old master is by a kind of miracle recalled from the grave." And when you printed the play, you chose a quotation from Virgil, which might be translated as, "What the gods themselves could not promise, revolving time has brought to light." The discovery of a lost play by Shakespeare must indeed have seemed like some divinely inspired miracle. Or were these all extravagant claims just part of the subterfuge? I have to ask a few questions. Some years ago, I got a group of actors together to read your Double Falsehood at Stratford-upon-Avon, where there is now a company dedicated to producing the work of Shakespeare. You would have approved of that, I think, Lewis. And although we greatly enjoyed it, we had some problems with it. We noticed that you had changed all the names from the original Cervantes story, the source material, but more seriously, that there seemed to be some missing scenes. Why did you cut the scene where Don Fernando gets into Dorothea's room? Surely Shakespeare would have jumped at that scene. Think of Iachimo and Imogen, or even Tarquin and Lucrece. And the scene where Fernando attempts to abduct Lucinda by being smuggled into a convent in a coffin. Jacobean drama is full of people leaping out of coffins, from Beaumont's quixotic The Night of the Burning Pestle to Middleton's A Chaste Maiden Cheapside, or Marston's Antonio and Melida. That abduction scene must surely have existed in the original play. You say you acquired a manuscript of Cardenio which was in the handwriting of John Downes, the famous old prompter from Drury Lane Theatre. Apparently the great tragedian Thomas Betterton was to have ushered the play into the world after the Restoration. His company had already mounted adaptations of Henry VIII and The Two Noble Kinsmen, both plays in which Shakespeare is said to have collaborated with John Fletcher. Although I know you will be surprised to learn that, Lewis. So it is feasible that they considered Cardenio for production. If so, it is highly probable that they would have adapted it, so perhaps these odd changes have nothing to do with you. Of course, it might be that the triumvirate of actor-managers who ran Drury Lane Theatre insisted on these changes. They had a reputation for being dismissive of new writing. How did you get on with them? Robert Wilkes, who was notoriously temperamental, was said to have been jealous of his rival, the theatre's leading tragic actor, Barton Booth, but neither of them much cared for plays in which they had to play second fiddle. Might this be why you changed the title from Cardenio to Double Falsehood? That way, Wilkes could play the irresistible villain and Booth the hero figure, Cardenio, and neither's nose would have been put out of joint. As Booth's wife, Hester, was playing the Dorothea role, Together, they must have been able to exert a considerable amount of pressure for whatever changes they required. I read you had a disaster on your opening night. One of your leads was off. Barton Booth hadn't been well and suffered a relapse. I can imagine the stress. It's your big break. Your play is about to open in one of the two major London theatres, with arguably one of the greatest actors of the day, and instead, an understudy goes on. You begged Booth to go back into the show. He did, but was seriously ill, and when he played the role on the 9th of January 1728, it turned out to be his last appearance on the stage. His wife never forgave you, did she? Double falsehood was part of your master plan, wasn't it? I feel for you. Since giving up a career in the law, you tried everything. Classical translation, poetry, opera libretto. You even published a magazine which folded and a novel which flopped. You were desperate to make it on the literary scene. You'd even tried adapting Shakespeare, attempting to apply the classical unities to Richard II and cutting about 1,000 lines. It was not a success. But you had found a lucrative niche writing pantomimes, which were all the rage in the 1720s. But I think your real ambition was to make your mark with Shakespeare. In 1725, you got your chance. The great poet of the Augustan age and your exact contemporary, Alexander Pope, published his edition of Shakespeare. Not only did you regard it as sloppy and inaccurate, you dislike his tendency to correct Shakespeare's rhyme and improve his meter. So you published your response, Shakespeare Restored, in 1726. Pope had a vicious wit, and satire was the rage of the age, so you must have known what an audacious step this was, about as risky today as taking on Private Eye. But attacking Pope was just one step of your master plan, and it was to put you on the map as Bar Dei Defensor. Step two, to secure your place in the pantheon of Shakespeare idolaters, your coup de théâtre was to produce a lost Shakespeare play. How did you feel when the plan backfired? Pope then published a poem called The Dunciad about all the stupid people in London and made you king of the dunces. I don't want to rub it in, Lewis, but he referred to you as Piddling Tybalt. And it was this title with which you were consigned to the footnotes of literary history for the next three centuries. I'm afraid. Pope smarted at the way you, a mere jumped-up writer of pantomimes, dared to criticise him, and in fact your scrupulous precision would stand you in good stead in the future. The Dunciad would charge you with jumping on a Shakespeare bandwagon for your own self-glorification. Yet even this creature may some notice claim, wrapped round and sanctified with Shakespeare's name. You did get to publish your own edition of Shakespeare in the end, and for one brilliant deduction in particular, you deserve our lasting thanks. Mistress Quickly has a baffling line in the folio about the death of Falstaff in Henry V. For his nose was as sharp as a pen, and a table of green fields. Pope suggested this was a stage direction, that a table was brought on stage belonging to a man called Greenfield, who must have been the property man at the Globe. But instead, you had the happy felicity to realise that Falstaff might, in his last moments, have babbled the green fields, sublime and Shakespeare restored indeed. You would be pleased to know that you are now widely considered to be one of the great Shakespeare editors of the 18th century. William Hogarth painted you as the distressed poet, punning on the subtitle of your play, I suppose, and you died in poverty in 1744. Only one person attended your funeral, your old friend, the prompter John Steed. But he has left us a sketch of your character. He was of a generous spirit, too generous for his circumstances, and none knew how to do a handsome thing with a better grace than himself. Now, Lewis, nearly 270 years after your death, controversy over double falsehoods continues, with some debate about whether it was a forgery after all. The manuscript that might have proved it, that was reported as late as 1770 as being treasured up in the Museum of Covent Garden Playhouse, was probably destroyed when that theatre burnt down in 1808. My own opinion? Well, I think you were fiercely ambitious, but I think you also loved Shakespeare too much to foist a total fabrication on the world. Although I notice you didn't include the play in your own later edition of Shakespeare's works. And your knowledge of the law would suggest that you would have not risked exposure. I think you inherited a script that had already been prepared for presentation in the restoration period, and you tidied it up a bit. But within it is still preserved some Shakespeare DNA. We should be cautious about attempting to recreate a Shakespeare play from that DNA. That would be like cloning dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. Sorry, Lewis, you won't understand that reference. But we can perhaps fill in the gaps in that genetic code and use your script to reimagine, with the help of Cervantes' original story, what such a play might have been like. So thanks, Lewis. We'll raise a glass in your memory. And if you are watching, enjoy the play.
Thanks very much, Greg. It's lovely to hear that. It's lovely to hear that read aloud. That phrase Shakespeare DNA leaps off the page.
And I think it's actually Stanley Wells's.
Stanley Wells' phrase after Greg Doran, after Lewis Tibbles, possibly adapted by, leaps off the page, Shakespeare DNA. Where for you is the Shakespeare DNA in Cardenio when you've been working with it?
Tiffany and I had a conversation about how little we actually know about how people collaborated. And if indeed Shakespeare and Fletcher did collaborate, it does seem to me to be possible that Shakespeare helped John Fletcher to plot the play. In the Cervantes, it's a very complicated series of flashbacks. The story begins with Don Quixote and Sancho Panza finding a dead mule in a stream, seeing a lunatic leap from rock to rock, calming the lunatic down enough to hear a bit of his story, later finding a young girl bathing her feet in a stream, and she tells her story, and you get it in little bite-sized pieces. So it took us quite a long time to reel it all out and work out A, B, C, D, what in a sort of narrative linear structure the play would have been. And it seems to me that it might be that Shakespeare helped Fletcher do that plotting. And if that's the case, that would be rather an interesting way of doing it. But it feels to me as though the writing is more Fletcher than Shakespeare.
And did you find within the Cardenio story in Don Quixote a five-act structure easily emerging, as it were?
It does.
And those are the kinds of things that Shakespeare, when he's using his source material for other plays, would have had to ask himself, wouldn't he?
Well, there are distinct differences. And one of those differences is the two fathers that get introduced into the play, particularly at the end. And when you get to the last act, it feels much more like a Shakespeare late play last act than it does in terms of the sort of end of the Cervantes story. Because in the end of the Cervantes story, he has a certain number of Spanish codes of honor and the position of the aristocrat in that piece that he has to uphold, and which are very common in classical Spanish plays of that period, particularly the sort of last acts, but are very un-Shakespearean. And yet, even though we had to change it around quite a lot within the rehearsal process, the final act does have a sort of, I don't know, it has a satisfying sense of reconciliation and reunion, which does seem to me to be familiar from late Shakespeare plays.
And in terms of the linguistic texture of the piece and the words as they sound in Double Falsehood or Distressed Lovers, and indeed in the Cardenio story according to Shelton, translated by Shelton, where do those very complex differences and negotiations sit alongside your own, you know, profoundly acute Shakespearean ear?
Well, I did think it was thin. And so at yet another stage in doing a workshop and having worked it out and having added the extra scenes and having, it still needed, I suppose, what I would describe as fortification. Mm-hmm. And I suppose I gave myself quite and my team a fairly strict parameter. We decided that what was rather extraordinary was that John Fletcher had written plays, at least six plays, based on Cervantes. So Cervantes was suddenly a new source of material for the writers of that period. So we decided, I went back to all the plays that Fletcher had written based on Cervantes, and I said to myself, I can pinch anything from any of those plays. And there were plays in which a friendship between two men was expressed, taken from The Curious Impertinent, where that friendship was betrayed, where there was a sense of loss from that. And these are plays, I suppose I didn't want to use plays that I thought may be future Swan plays, but I can't see us getting round to John Fletcher's The Queen of Corinth. I'm sorry if anybody here is a great fan of The Queen of Corinth, but it felt to me as though that wasn't going to be... But in that play, there is a character who has been raped and who has a very moving soliloquy about her experience. So there were times when I thought, well, there are holes. It isn't going to stand up without it. I don't want to pastiche. I'm not a writer. I can edit those bits in a theatre format, but I can't... And it was quite interesting listening to the critics kind of going, oh, I think that bit's by Shakespeare. And I was going, actually, that's by... that's by me, sorry.
Tiffany, if I may put a similar question to you. Where for you in either Cardenio, as you've come to experience it through Greg's production, or in Double Falsehood, would you sense a Shakespeare DNA? Whether or not you think that is an imitated DNA by Theobald, and also from what Greg has just said about going to some of Fletcher's other plays, some of the kinds of themes he was describing just now sounded very like The Two Noble Kinsmen, which, you know, we can definitely use as a kind of control in this, as a Fletcher-Shakespeare collaboration.
I think we can make a better case, as I've said before, for Fletcher than for Shakespeare. We can raise questions about the authorship of Two Noble Kinsmen that are Fletcher-Shakespeare designation is from 1634. I mean, actually, and what we have done is say Two Noble Kinsmen is by Fletcher and Shakespeare because of this late designation. It's also in the complete works of Beaumont and Fletcher, so we can... But we have said that. We have said that Cardenio is by Shakespeare and Fletcher. We have then guessed that they are collaborating at that time. We have then guessed that Henry VIII is also by Fletcher and Shakespeare. We have then forgotten that that was our process. And we have used the fact that Henry VIII is by Fletcher and Shakespeare as his Two Noble Kinsmen to back prove that Cardenio is, you know, it's a totally circular argument. If I can just address a couple of the things. One question was I'm slightly sidestepping this simply because as I don't really think there's Shakespeare in there, I don't quite know what to say about that. But one question was, as Theobald really did care about Shakespeare and really did care about editing, would he have lied in that fashion? And I think that's maybe to phrase it slightly the wrong way. He did write in imitation of Shakespeare's style and say so, and he also wrote in imitation of Shakespeare's style and didn't say so, as with his play Orestes, when it's a play by him, but he is sending bits of it off to his friend Warburton saying, does this remind you of anyone? and then he's going, I fancied it was maybe a little Shakespeare-esque. So, and this is a Theobald word, Shakespeare-esque. So I'm not really talking about forging exactly, but he certainly Shakespeares his way onto things, both when he says he's doing that and when he doesn't so explicitly say he's doing that. And I think there is another question, which is, if we say, well, he wasn't lying, he did have one or some manuscripts, we then have to deal with the fact that here is an editor of Shakespeare and Fletcher whose manuscript disappears. He doesn't publish it either as Fletcher or Shakespeare, and whatever he does with it it doesn't emerge later. So we'd then have to deal with an editor who worships these people, who has somehow got rid of a manuscript because it's embarrassing to him. So that is very awkward, because the story that the manuscript ended up in, or a manuscript ended up in Covent Garden, doesn't really actually make sense. It's often told, but what is treasured up in Covent Garden, according to the advertisements, is the manuscript of Double Falsehood, not the manuscript of Cardenio.
Why would that be treasured up?
Because it's a notable play. You know, this Shakespeare-style play. And the other thing is, we know exactly what was burnt when Covent Garden burnt down, because if you look at all the newspapers, they list what is lost, and they do not list a Shakespeare manuscript of any kind lost. They do list a lot of Handel and Ahner's original music lost, and they list the props, and they say, and the whole library, which had first performance texts of all their plays, and I think what they'd got hold of was a 1740 text, I think. There are questions also about the restoration, this odd restoration manuscript that both Greg and I are projecting may well have existed. But there are problems with that story, and I'll simply tell you the problems, and then we can have tea. The problems are this. If it's in the hands of John Downes, the famous prompter, and it's for Thomas Betterton, the famous actor, then that's in the theatre run by William Davenant, the famous playwright, who also on occasion claimed to be Shakespeare's illegitimate son. So we then have a playwright who claims to be Shakespeare's illegitimate son and who loves Shakespeare. The actor Thomas Betterton, he was obsessed with Shakespeare. He came to Stratford on a pilgrimage, one of the first people to do this, to gather what remaining information there was about Shakespeare, which he then gave to Rowe, and it made its way into Rowe's edition. And then we have John Downes, the prompter. He loves Shakespeare. He publishes Roscius Anglicanus, which is really a list of plays that are doing well and why. And he loves Shakespeare plays because they do well. So we then have three guys with a Shakespeare manuscript which they cut down and then never put on. And that is an odd story. You were sort of, if they thought they had a Shakespeare manuscript, why didn't they big it up? Why didn't they go all out for it? Surely they should all have been obsessed for their different reasons with this manuscript. Which also, again, makes me question, if they did have a restoration manuscript, maybe they, those guys, did not think it was by Shakespeare. Maybe the Shakespeare designation got itself onto that manuscript later.
I find myself feeling Shakespearean and Shakespeare-esque at the same time as I listen to both of you speak. Thank you ever so much for that first part. We're now going to take a break for about 20 minutes. There's tea and coffee served in the bar area outside. Have a look at the displays we've got on, and do come back with some questions for the second half, please. In the meantime, let's thank Greg and Tiffany very much indeed.